Renthal Street Chain and Sprockets are perfectly matched for maximum power transfer and efficiency. From racetrack to daily rider, with over 800 fitments, Renthal Street has a final drive solution for almost any bike. Use Renthal.com to find the correct fitment.
395. No, it won't be the 2028 MotoGP top speed, but instead something equally spectacular as the newest and latest Paddock Pass podcast rushes into existence. I'm Adam Wheeler, and I wish I could say I'm delighted to be connected with two other wise and old hacks, but the truth is that I've seen far better things on my computer screen today. In the interest of productivity, though, and catharsis, because this will also be on YouTube, I will endeavour to make the best introductions for David Emmett and Neil Morrison. Dave, you've been in the UK, and sharing some childhood photos from your family home on WhatsApp with us recently, the sheer innocence of those Emmett Jr. images are just ruining things for me here, because when I look at my own children, I know what could be in store.
Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's the old, picture of Dorian Gray thing, isn't it? Only in real life. All that innocence and youthful beauty. It soon ran out there, sort of pretty much as soon as I hit my late 20s, it was all gone. So, yes, that's something for your kids to look forward to. But I'll tell you what I really enjoyed, and I posted the photo the picture on Twitter as well, of me sitting on my uncle's grass track bikes as about, I would have been aged like maybe 5 or 6. I still remember that feeling of joy. And it's the same feeling I get every time I swing my leg over a motorbike. It, you know, some things just never go away.
There's a great photo, Dave, of you when you're maybe about 12 at a family function dressed in like rather fancy clothes and you're you're sporting a wonderful scowl, which is really reminiscent of when you're made to wait a bit too long at a rider's debrief at the end of a test day.
That was, I mean, yes, no, but my mother literally said about me that she was the worst teenager she ever came across. So, yeah. And I look back at all those pictures. There's like pictures of me, all sorts of doing all sorts of family things. And by God, I knew how to look miserable.
I don't know. Those kind of official school photographs look pretty quaint, Dave. I mean, is there any chance you could post one maybe on Patreon Discord or even on your own Twitter thing? I would do it just for those flowing locks.
Yeah, no, that would, that's, I'm trying to limit the exposure of my photographs to the world. It's not good for anyone, least of all for me.
Neil, you've been busting the pedal power in the last 2 weeks and you won't be coming to Austin this week. How difficult was it to resist the allure of an authentic American burger?
More difficult to resist the lure of the authentic Austin tacos, I would have to say, the breakfast tacos in particular. Dave and I were talking last night about how difficult it's going to be to miss out on that this year. But with Argentina's cancellation, money-wise, it didn't really make sense just to go out to America for 5 days because it's just got so expensive. And I thought I would maybe save some funds for later in the year when I'll be going to Japan for the first time. So I think should make up for it.
Well, speaking of cancellations, British Airways have already cancelled my flight, so it's going to be fun flying to Dallas instead of Houston and then driving on. Let's see if I can actually get there first. Coming up, we're going to blast through 6 talking points or topics before round 3 and the Red Bull Grand Prix of the Americas, including Fabio Quartararo's contract extension, Cota form, and a bit more. But first, last year, KTM made a surprise model launch when they unveiled a limited edition KTM RC8C track bike. The motorcycle sold out in minutes and the company have produced a 2024 version. We have to stress that this is not a road bike. It's 100% for the circuit and it can only be ordered online as limited to 100 units. So anybody keen on a ready-to-race torque fest of potential might have already missed out. It weighs 142 kilograms with a special track chassis and is loaded with WB Pro components. The LC8C engine spits out 135 horsepower and there's a slew of race-ready specs like Brembo brakes, a crap of exhaust and lots of aero. Expect Moto2 levels of performance. Purchasing the KTM RC8C also involves a VIP handover event on May the 8th at Portimao. That includes a track setup session, dinner, a meet and greet, and exclusive track day experience with KTM Race Royalty. Have a look at KTM.com now and check the Supersport category under models just to see if there's any of those special machines left. Okay, guys, first of all, the news came out. Fabio Quartararo, let's talk about him. Dave, does money talk, or is Fabio being overly optimistic about Yamaha's soon swift return to competitiveness?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's complicated. I wrote a big story about this last night on motormatters.com. It seems from reporting by Oriol Puigdemont, who knows these sort of things, who writes for motorsport.com, that the choices that Fabio had was 12 million euros to stay where he is, making him the best paid rider on the grid, or 4 million at Aprilia. So he didn't have a lot of options. And yes, 12 million is nice, but I think there's more to it than that. I think there's also, money can also be an expression of how much the stakes or the skin a factory has in the game. So if you're paying someone a lot of money, you also need to give them the tools to do the job. You know, there's no point in throwing sort of, you know, millions and millions at a rider and then sort of spending 60 quid on some bloke in a shed in Altrincham to build a MotoGP bike for them. You really need to sort of invest to extract the investment. And that's the gamble that they actually, that Yamaha, or that really that Fabio is making. He's saying, look, yes, I'll take the money, but you need to make sure that I can win on this. You know, he's forcing Yamaha into investing in him, but also investing in the bike to give him the changes. But also, we've seen at the Sepang test, Yamaha have made a lot of changes, and Fabio has been raving about the changes made, such as at especially the arrival of Max Bartolini, the performance engineer. And what a difference he's made in the garage. So, yeah, I think it's the money was nice. There was also a bit of a lack of options, but also by forcing, you know, he's trying to force Yamaha to give him what he needs.
Two things. Maybe, Neil, you can come in here first. You know, Yamaha was clearly the best option for Fabio, but is Fabio really the right option for Yamaha? You know, he has an important input for the development of the M1 and maybe the direction of the motorcycle for the next couple of years now. And secondly, if Yamaha are able to spunk, say, Audio's on the money in terms of getting the money right with 12 million, then what does that mean for having a second team? You know, if they do ink a deal with VR46, then we're talking about some serious budget going into their MotoGP program again, right?
Yeah, I think that's always been the way with the Japanese factories in MotoGP. They've always been able to spend a bit more on rider salaries than their European counterparts. Is Fabio the best option for Yamaha? Yeah, I would say so. He's the best option available. I still think Fabio is definitely among the best five riders in the world currently, the best five riders in MotoGP for sure. With the right tools at his disposal, I have no doubt that he would be fighting for the world championship. And, you know, Yamaha have been able to see how he works up closely over the last couple of years. Obviously, he brought them a title in 2021. And if you think about it, this crisis that Yamaha are currently engulfed in would have begun a lot earlier than it did had Fabio not been there. The likes of Rossi, Vinales, Morbidelli were all having torrid times when Fabio was winning the championship in 2021 and nearly winning the championship in 2022. So yeah, I think you could say that it's definitely a great deal for Yamaha. And in terms of the budget that they've had, I think, you know, they have had to really demonstrate to Fabio that they do mean business. And, you know, the salary is one part of that. But some of the changes that they've mentioned, I think, also played a big role. Max Bartolini coming across from Ducati. Also, I think it was Marco Nicotra, who's now their senior aerodynamics engineer, has come across from Ducati as well. That's an aspect of bike development that Yamaha had before neglected to address. It does seem that they're kind of on board with that. So there's been big structural changes to how they operate, as well as changes to the bike. And yeah, it was enough to convince him in the end. Part of me would love to have seen Fabio jump ship and go to a different factory. But realistically, you know, he was never going to be in the running for the factory Ducati team, just because they already have a line of three very, very capable riders trying to take that seat alongside Pekka Bagnaia next year. And then Aprilia, you know, if Oriol is on the money, he usually is. Taking a salary which is a third of what your current employer is offering, I mean, it's difficult to do that. And we do have to remind ourselves that Fabio still is only 24 years old. He turns 25 later this month. So it's not like a kind of Marc Marquez situation last year where you feel he's coming to the end of his career and he needs to make a big change to be competitive immediately. You know, Fabio does still have many years ahead of him. So, I can see why he's done this.
Quick question. You said that you think that Fabio is still one of the top five riders in the world. Who are the other four?
Mark, Pecco, Martin, and
Pedro.
Acosta, probably.
Acosta already in MotoGP?
Yeah.
That's a big call.
Yeah, no question. That was, I mean, like, that's the one thing about Acosta. I did watch the races. Obviously, you know, I couldn't be there because I was with my mum, but I did watch the races, and watching Pedro Acosta sliding both wheels through turn 15 at Portimao, you're thinking, okay, this kid might be okay, might be, you know, sort of semi-decent on the bike.
A question I would like to pose to both of you: has Fabio bottled this? Because we've seen Aprilia has the potential to have at least finished on the podium in the first two runs of the season. It looks potential-wise like it could be excellent. We know that Fabio historically is a better rider than both Aleix and Maverick. I mean, this is a chance to jump onto a ready-made competitive package that can fight with Ducati. Do you think that it's a missed opportunity for him?
I think it's the conflict between short-term and long-term, because short-term, Neil, you're right. I mean, if Quartararo is thinking, you know, 2025, I want to win the championship here and now, then yeah, maybe he has been a little bit cagey. But if he's looking a little bit further down the line, I mean, I was just doing the research now, actually. I mean, Monster Energy did their last contract renewal in 2022 with Yamaha. I mean, it's an association that's been going for 10 years. They've been title sponsors, I just looked it up, since 2019. So you'd imagine if Yamaha have the kind of budget to be able to sign Quartararo like that, and then they're also going to be dealing with another team for two more M1s, then, you know, have Monster been able to stump up? And frustratingly, it says a multi-year contract extension. So we don't know if 2024 is the end of it and they're already talking for future years and they've got that extra money to secure things. But I think Quartararo must be in a position where he's surrounded by the kind of activity, the promises, maybe early telltale signs that things are improving. And if he knows that it's a work in progress, perhaps very much like Luca Marini's found out in his first month's HRC, that there is going to be some sort of light at the end of the tunnel, then why not take the massive paycheck and think, okay, I'm going to be able to win Grand Prix again in a year's time? I mean, it might not even really be that long.
Two things. First of all, look at Marc Marquez. I mean, there is no question about Marc Marquez's ability, and yet it is still taking him time to adapt. So first of all, you have the point that if the character of the Aprilia and the Yamaha are relatively simple in that they're both sort of quite high corner speed bikes, Quartararo would still take time to adapt to a different bike. He's never ridden another bike. So that means he's losing at least half a season. Then, of course, we've got rules changing in 2027, and everyone's building new bikes, so we've got no real guarantees about what happens after that. And finally, I mean, why would you not sign for Aprilia? Well, what happened to Maverick Rinia Vinales in the Grand Prix on Sunday at Portimao? His gearbox sort of locks up or stopped working for no particular reason. It's not uncommon for Aprilia to have technical problems. There are rumours and sort of a chat around the paddock that things are not always as well organised behind the scenes as it should be. These things get back to riders. You know, you see a string of technical failures. We've talked about it before on the podcast. You know, like Aleix Espargaró, I think in Metegi, when he forgets, the thing is still on the rate or still on the out on the sighting lap, and you know the heat problems that they've had, and then other technical problems. The list is endless, and every time they fix something, they seem to create a new problem. That is not a sign of long-term thoughtful engineering. It is a sign of a very aggressive approach to development, but it's a big, big risk as well. So I think maybe Fabio has sort of looked at that and thought about the risk, and if it had been offered more money, then maybe he'd have taken it, but otherwise not. And the other thing about Ducati were never going to offer him a lot of money, because they only ever offer one rider a lot of money. That's going to Fabio, to Pecco Bagnaia. Obviously, he deserved it. He's won a bunch of he's won two championships on the bounce now. But they basically tell you, you know, what we offer you is not a lot of money, but a bike you can win a championship on, and then go off and find, you know, source your own sponsorships and stuff to make money on it.
I mean, Quartararo's won a championship. We don't really know the extent of his hunger and his ambition. If he wants to be somebody who wants to log, you know, his name in many columns in the record books, or he's, you know, happy already being there. But Neil, I mean, we don't have to jump off the Quartararo subject immediately, but I think now this puts almost the spotlight onto Jorge Martin, because he's going to be facing the same situation. Does he try to go for that factory Ducati seat, or does he re-sign again for, you know, Bologna on a reduced fee, or does he take the sort of 4 million for Aprilia and have faced the same sort of dilemma that Dave was pointing out for Quartararo there?
Yeah, it does reduce his options somewhat. I think he could probably had Honda into that mix ad and, you know, ask for 10 million euros or however much from HRC to try and tempt him away. But yeah, he definitely faces some big decisions in the next couple of weeks or next couple of months. Doesn't seem like Ducati are in any huge hurry to sort of decide who Pecco Bagnaia's teammate will be next year. But yes, I would say Yamaha was the obvious, or Martin was the obvious replacement if Quartararo did leave. And now that option is close to him. But yeah, I think if you're Jorge, it sort of boils down to those three factories. I mean, you know, Ducati factory or maybe a place in Aprilia or Honda.
I think the longer it takes for Ducati to make a decision about who's going to be riding alongside Pecco Bagnaia, the greater the probability that it's going to be Andrea Bastianini. At least that's definitely the feeling that I get.
Would Bastianini, if he's ejected out of there, go to Pramac, Dave? Would that be, or is that
too- No, if he will go to Aprilia. I mean, basically, it's going to be, I think one of the seats in Aprilia is going to be between Bastianini and Martin. Maybe even both, who knows? But yeah, I think that whoever doesn't get the factory Ducati ride is going to be looking at the factory Aprilia ride as either first or second choice, probably as a second choice, because the factory Ducati ride is absolutely sort of it's a locked in chance to win a world championship. However, you will get paid whatever Gigi Delinea finds sort of down the back of his sofa in terms of salary.
Guys, I would put it to you that, you know, on the eve of the Red Bull Grand Prix of the Americas, there's going to be a lot of attention, of course, on the Trackhouse team. I think they've even got some of their NASCAR or some of their Cup cars doing some demo laps at the weekend at Cota. Or Aprilia, perhaps the manufacturer most in transition or looking the most unstable in terms of what riding personnel and kind of team investment they could have for next year. I mean, KTM look a little bit more consistent. I mean, you'd say the popularity of Jack Miller, of course, Pedro Acosta retaining him is going to be priority number one. Brad Binder's already sorted. So that's three spots there you would assume are going to be full for the Austrians, whether that's going to be two KTM teams or it's going to be Gas again, or perhaps even MV Agusta, who this week launched their Veloce Enduro or kind of adventure model. So, I mean, things are already moving for MV Agusta. So I would say that, yeah, okay, of course, Honda with Joan Mir. I mean, he's somebody else that's coming to the end of his contract cycle. We shouldn't discount him because he's a former world champion, of course. But Aprilia just seems to have a lot more question marks around them than any other brand at the moment.
I think all four. I think Aprilia could lose all four riders easily. And the only person who would have any choice in that would be Aleix Espargaró. I think if Aleix Espargaró wants to continue racing, he can continue racing in the factory Aprilia team unless, you know, something remarkable happens. And I think also the fact that Quartararo signed for Yamaha rather than Aprilia, it increases the chance of Aleix keeping his seat.
As we said, our second talking point, the team focus on track house is going to be pretty big this weekend, Neil. Joe Roberts finished on the podium last time out and now being linked heavily with the American racing setup for 2025. You know, it's going to be a cool Grand Prix, you'd imagine, in Texas this weekend for the newbies. What do we think about Trackhouse? I mean, do they already have the clout and the possibility to overhaul the riding lineup, as Dave says, or will they be a little bit more cagey and sticking with Miguel Oliveira would be a sound move?
Yeah, I think at the moment, Miguel Oliveira would be, I mean, I think it's way too early, I think, to be talking about who's going to be at Trackhouse next year and whether Miguel Oliveira needs to stick around or not, because you know, he hasn't shown anything close to his full potential this year so far. He was decent in Portugal without being spectacular. But yeah, I guess the Roberts link is definitely a valid one. And just with everything that's happened over the last couple of weeks with the Liberty Media acquisition of MotoGP, I was sort of thinking back to some of the recent things that have happened. And it does make a lot of sense now that don't want to push so hard to get crypto data and RNF out of MotoGP, getting an American team in there, which could potentially field an American rider in the near future. I mean, that would definitely have been a nice little sweetener for the, you know, the Liberty owners to look at. But yeah, it should be a really interesting weekend for the Trackhouse team. As I said, you know, Oliveira still isn't quite up to speed yet with the new Aprilia, but I think there were signs in Portugal that he's coming to understand the new package, and I think it will be just a matter of time. He is obviously a quality rider, and once he kind of understands it, I think we can, you know, expect him to be showing some of the form that we saw in the first half of last year before he was plagued by a succession of nasty injuries.
Dave, when you see the puzzle pieces being clicked into place, it does make you realize that discussions behind the scenes are ongoing even months and years in advance, as Neil hints, you know, with the kind of maneuvers with regards to the teams, the nationalities, the deals that are being talked about and could potentially happen. I mean, we must also mustn't forget that Liberty Media, the deal is agreed in principle and it's in place, but still needs to be passed through some various regulations, approval processes before it's all completely signed off. But Trackhouse are now, I would argue, one of the more curious teams in the paddock just because of the ownership and the potential and, you know, some of the maybe left-wing changes that we could see coming into the sport.
Yes, there are definitely going to be changes, but I still think Liberty's main focus is going to be on promoting the sport in the US. It was also quite interesting. There was a story in the Financial Times that Bridgepoint actually turned down a higher bid for Dorna. Something like $200 million more from TKO, I believe the organization is, which also own UFC and a couple of other championships.
WWE.
Yeah, exactly. They said something because of cultural changes. Again, I think we escaped or cultural differences. I think all of the fans saying, you know, worrying about Liberty turning MotoGP into WWE dodged a bullet there. Clearly the talk for Bridgepoint, that has been going on for at least a year. So that would make a lot of sense about, you know, replacing CryptoData RNF, a team which was on, you know, financially extremely dubious ground anyway, with a big American name linked with a big American sport to sell it to a big American entertainment organization. It does make a lot of sense. And it also, I think it really shifts the focus to racing in the US. And I think it also really increases the chances of seeing a second GP in the US.
Yeah, I think we saw Greg Maffei, the CEO of Liberty Media, speaking to one of the American news channels last week. I forget which one, MSNBC it might have been, in which he was saying just that, Dave, that you know, they're looking at expanding the kind of presence in America in terms of number of races. He didn't think there would be a chance to hold as many as three races like there is in Formula One, but certainly they were looking at, or they will be looking at alternatives, or maybe another event to run alongside COTA, which I think is interesting. And yeah, I also saw an interview with Carmelo Ezpeleta, CEO of Dorna, I think with Mr. Helmet on YouTube, in which he was saying that, yeah, this deal was basically a year or just over a year in the making. So that kind of runs back to last year. And it also makes you wonder about Dan Rossomondo's appointment. Was that also something to show that Dorna wasn't just a company based in Spain with an entirely Spanish upper management group? You know, it was willing to branch out a little bit and to kind of add to its roster names from a more international background.
Yeah, I think you know, Dorna are actually going to be holding a press conference prior to the Red Bull Grand Prix of Americas this week, so maybe we'll get some more answers, perhaps some insight on the timing there. But let's move on to our third point here in the podcast today, guys. And I've got an interesting question for you. You know, the Circuit of the Americas is a venue where we usually see some of the, you know, some of the old, you know, legends of the past, some of the old races popping up from Grand Prix history. So I have a question: which American racer from 1985 to 1995 would fare best in MotoGP today? And before I get your answers on that one, I'm going to say mine, which I'm going to nominate Wayne Rainey, purely because of mentality, I think. You know, I do wonder how he'll cope in this sort of era of promotion and social media and being outspoken and stuff. I don't think he really had that extroverted kind of personality that you maybe saw in terms of sort of Kevin Schwantz or a Randy Mamola. But, you know, I think Rainey's approach and his dedication in terms of bike setup and getting everything on point, you know, would really work in the current era of MotoGP. But also a quick mention to Pat Hennen, who was, of course, the first Premier Class Grand Prix winner from the US, passed away this week. So thoughts of him. It was only 70, I think. Boulder Count's quite a shy guy. I mean, we wanted to get Dennis Noyes on the podcast this week to talk a bit about Pat, because I'm sure the guys would have known each other. But I think Dennis is actually going to join us on the post Austin show. We can ask him then. Dave as well, I know you sort of quite really into Neil, of course, too, into the history of the sport. And Pat Hennen was a rider.
I can't remember what happened last week. I don't know why you're asking me about history.
Well, Pat Hennen was like a guy, I think, you know, really used the prominence of the Daytona 200 to, you know, really launch his name on the international stage. There was riders that were very sort of famous in the US, Gene Romero, Gary Nixon, never really made that transition to the world championship, but Hennen used that sort of springboard. And Neil, really, it was a shame that his story was over so soon, you know, due to an accident at the Isle of Man.
Yeah, exactly. I think he was a rider with great potential. My parents, I think, were there at the TT that year when he was racing in 1978, and said just that you could tell that he was immediately could tell that he was from American. Just the kind of the white leathers were a total contrast to what you would see from most of the road racers that you know, had grown up racing around road circuits in Ireland. Yeah, you have to say he was a pretty handy rider. I mean, I never really got to see him ride, but that year in the 500cc World Championship, I think he was just 1 point ahead of Kenny Roberts before the TT, leading that championship, which was obviously, it went on to become a real famous duel between Kenny Roberts Sr. and Barry Sheen. He went to the TT that year because his salary was so low, I think, from Heron Suzuki. And he needed the kind of the start money from the TT to basically, you know, make a bit of coin, and you know, showed himself to be a pretty handy rider there. Just before his crash, I think he set the first ever sub 20-minute lap of the Isle of Man. He was battling with Tom Herron for victory when he had that crash at Bishop's Court, which is a really, really fast part of the track. So, yeah, it was sad to hear that that he passed away this week. And one of those stories of you know, what could have been had it not been for that accident.
The accident was, it's never been fully cleared up, has it? I mean, there's some people that say that he was struck by a bird on the helmet. There was other people that say he clipped a curb. And there was even some debate that he may have even had contact with his teammate. But yeah, talk about sliding doors moments. I mean, Henan pretty much didn't vanish from the sport. He was still working in the motorcycle industry after that. But it really is a what could have been kind of question mark, really, in sort of 500cc Grand Prix racing history.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, one of those things where, I mean, would he have gone on to have the success in the sport as someone like Kenny Roberts Jr. or then after that, Freddie Spencer? Maybe not. I don't think he was as big a talent as that. But then for someone that is, you know, was relatively new to the World Championship, he was doing a pretty good job. So, yeah, we'll sadly never know.
Dave, who's your American racer then that would prosper in MotoGP today?
My American racer who would prosper in MotoGP is Eddie Lawson, in part because I mean, and Neil will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Lawson won on three different brands. He won on a Honda, a Yamaha, and a Kajiva. Yeah. I think he won back-to-back championships on different brands as well. He was just exceptional. Talking about the attitude and approach necessary, Lawson absolutely had it. He was only interested in one thing, and that was winning and beating other people and making other people's lives miserable. And that is what it takes to succeed at this sort of level. I think he was also one of the first riders to start properly training, to start, you know, like using fitness as a tool. So I actually think that Lawson is criminally underrated, even though he is still rated as one of the greatest in the world. But I think he's often overlooked because of the glamour of Schwantz and because of the relentlessness of Rainey. But I think Lawson is a bit overlooked, and I think Lawson would have had what it takes to really succeed in the current era of MotoGP. He would have got his head around everything that needed doing. He was smart as well. He was very smart. But he would have had the smarts to get his head around how to ride a MotoGP bike with all of the best, all of the bits and pieces sort of quickly. He didn't rely on natural talent. He had natural talent, but he also had the intelligence to understand that sometimes you need to do things differently to go fast.
We are talking about 2024 MotoGP here, Dave, so I can imagine Eddie Lawson dancing to a TikTok video very nicely. I'm sure that would be a great fit. I would also like to be...
There's a great interview. It's a fantastic interview clip somewhere. I can't remember, but it is basically a TV interview has gone up to him standing outside his motorhome, and he's sort of standing there with his shirt off being interviewed, and Eddie Lawson, he looks like the TV interviewer is holding a live turd in front of his in face instead of a microphone. Genuinely, the look of just sheer disdain and disgust on his face is just magnificent. And for that, I salute
him.
Well,
I would like to be front and center of his media debriefs when you're asking him questions, you know, about his rear tire. I'm sure it would have been fantastic reactions. I can remember seeing an interview with him. There was a pit lane reporter for TV chasing after him. I think it was the 1988 87 Austrian Grand Prix at Salzburgring, trying to keep up with him, asking him what's going on, why he's not being competitive that weekend, and he just gives some sort of answer like, yeah, bike race is like shit. That's it. You kind of think, you know, I would just, can you imagine sort of Pekka Bagnaia or, you know, kind of Brad Binder or someone doing that today? It's it just wouldn't happen. Yeah. I'm not sure Eddie would be the best equipped for the modern era of sports promotion.
Can you imagine the press officer? Yeah, Eddie. Look, we've got this media training lined up for you. Are you available on the 23rd? Yeah, good luck with that one.
But I think your point about adapting to different motorcycles and machinery. I mean, if he was facing a 12 million or a 4 million euro contract decision between motorcycles, then perhaps the money would not be such a factor for somebody so versatile and, you know, attuned to the purposes of racing. But then I think, one thing, I couldn't really stand Eddie Lawson. I just didn't feel, I couldn't relate to him very much. And I was too young to appreciate his technical skills. But he was kind of unpredictable. I mean, to be able to sort of leave the Japanese or behemoth at the time and jump on a very unproven Italian product in Grand Prix racing and make it a success just shows a lot about the man's class. Neil, is there somebody who stands out for you, or are you an Eddie fan as well?
I mean, I'm a big Eddie fan for sure. I can see sense in both of your decisions. I would probably opt for Freddie Spencer. If we wanted one single season, or maybe two, seasons of brilliance. I think Freddie was probably the most naturally gifted rider of all of the Americans. So I think he would have had talent to adapt to MotoGP machine as quickly as anyone, if not quicker. And there were a couple of facets of his riding, which I think would have stood him in fantastic stead for modern day MotoGP. Firstly, he could start ridiculously quickly. I remember writing an article about him during the pandemic and going back and watching some of the old races from like the mid-80s. And basically the race was decided after half a lap. It was kind of like what you see in Formula One nowadays. Spencer would have got the whole shot, and not just got the whole shot, but would have got 2 seconds of whole shot and been able to basically start riding at ridiculously fast pace from the very start, which I don't think many other riders could have done. So the race was basically over after a lap or two. We know how important starting and starting the races quickly now is. So I think that would work in his favor. And also, he seemed to have a kind of almost otherworldly feel for the front tire. His autobiography was titled Feel. And he did countless dirt track races, riding on dirt when he was younger, and how he could kind of feel the front tire, I think, was something that was not really seen in motorbike racing at that time. And we know how tricky it is to manage front tire pressure at the moment. So I think that would also work in his favor. So his right wrist might not be the strongest, and he might not be able to do a load of consistent races for more than a season or two. But I think if you wanted one standout season, I think Freddie could be your man.
It's a superb argument, Neil, especially because my first thought when you nominated Freddie Spence was that maybe you had made some dodgy calls in Moto 2 and Moto 3 commentary about track limits and were looking to regain some credit back in your name. But good observations, of course. Dave, my question about Freddie Spencer is there parallels to Marc Marquez where, you know, he's a fantastic, marvelous talent, but then it's only really proven on one motorcycle and one brand?
Yeah, I mean, also, careers very much marked by injury. Although I think Freddie's was cut short a lot earlier than the Mark's was. But yes, agreed. But I mean, it was different for Freddie Spencer. It was different times. There was a lot less choice then. Obviously, there was a lot less sort of breadth of competitive machinery. And I think he just had to retire too early, really. That was his biggest problem, was just how incredibly short his career was.
Maybe we shouldn't Burnout. Ask Giacomo Agostini about hiring Freddie Spencer. That could be a little bit contentious. But, you know, let's ask it to the listeners. We've chosen Wayne Rainey, Eddie Lawson, and Freddie Spencer as our sort of top American racers from that 10-year fantastic era for the country in the sport. Send us some comments on Twitter or on SoundCloud or wherever you listen to this podcast. Let us know who you'd pick. I mean, none of us opted for Kevin Schwantz, guys. I mean, is that a failing of ours, or is the injury record just too much of a disadvantage?
Did Schwantz, I mean, to me, like, Schwantz was spectacular to watch. And he did a lot on talent. He did a lot. Schwantz had a riding style, and he was going to follow that riding style and nothing else. Now, and they made a bike which allowed him to be really competitive. He was, you know, much faster than the Suzuki. It was very much him winning rather than Suzuki winning. But he, again, we're talking about sort of like, you know, swapping manufacturers and stuff. Schwantz is forever linked to Suzuki. And how would he have fared if he'd have been jumping off of different bikes, you know, jumping between bikes? I think Schwantz could have gone one or two ways. He could have gone a bit like Valentino Rossi jumping off the Yamaha and onto the Ducati sort of thing. So, that could have gone one of two ways. He could have either been sort of outstanding or failed. And I think that if Schwantz was on the right bike, he would have figured it out. But if he wasn't on the right bike, I think he would have struggled a lot more.
Neil, are we also being dismissive of Randy's natural talent and maybe John Kaczynski as well? I mean, there's a rider who could just jump on various types of motorcycles and won with most of them. You know, and I would argue as well, Dave, your point about Schwantz and Suzuki is fantastic. Is he perhaps the biggest case of what if in terms of never changing a brand or a motorcycle, or does that honor fall to Mick Doohan?
I guess so. Yeah, I think we all wanted Mick to change brands just for an entertainment point of view, because it was quite tedious watching him clean up in certain years in 500s. I think Schwantz would have made a success of any switch that he made. To be honest, he was that naturally gifted, that strong. And what are we talking? Oh, yeah, Randy or John. I mean, yeah, Mamola and Kaczynski were both super riders, but when we're talking about the best American riders, we're talking about the riders of all time, or, you know, several of the best riders of all time. And they weren't quite at that level, I would say, but they were still very, very good. But yeah, there's no way you would put Randy or John Kaczynski ahead of the likes of Rainey or Lawson, Spencer or Schwantz, or Kenny Roberts Sr. I think that's a more pertinent one that we should be mentioning.
Going off on a complete tangent, my hot take is that Mick Doohan is single-handedly responsible for the MotoGP class, because it was so boring watching that era. He was so much better than everyone else, and he had so little interest in everything else. And it coincided with the rise of, you know, you had Crafar and Aaron Slight and Carl Fogarty. That era of World Superbikes, absolutely fantastic racing. The manufacturers were getting bored with two strokes anyway, and I think Doohan was very much pounding the nails into the coffin of the two stroke era and ushering in the MotoGP. So that is my completely unfounded and wild take on how MotoGP came about.
Well, MotoGP exists because of the peak of development when it came to the two strokes in the early 90s, right? I mean, you know, when Doohan started riding a big bang, you know, you could see, I wouldn't say the beginning of the end, but there was definitely going to be a sort of cycle that was reaching some sort of apex there. But yeah, I mean, good points, Dave. But we can count Kenny Roberts. Can we count Junior as well there? I mean, as a world champion, we are trying to identify American races that would fit into current MotoGP.
He did ride a four. I mean, he did fit into MotoGP. He actually rode a MotoGP bike and almost and came very close to winning a MotoGP race as well. But we've already had one American racer in from that era in MotoGP.
Point four. Laguna Seca finally had like a $20 million investment. I think last year it was completed, guys. They did some renovations on the paddock, also resurfaced the track. They built a new bridge that goes from the paddock to the exterior of the track. Could MotoGP go back? Maybe there's still some critical elements of that circuit in terms of runoff and safety that means that, you know, Grand Prix racing can't visit there again. But thanks to sort of Steve English, our SWR colleague on the Paddock Pass podcast, he was telling us a bit about Flat Rock, which is a brand new circuit less than 2 hours from Nashville, about 3 hours from Atlanta, with a very distinctive kind of bank turn. It's had Tilke helping with the development of the layout and the whole facility. It's supposed to be opening in 2024, but that's also been a venue mooted for a second or perhaps a replacement stop for MotoGP in the United States. I just wondered, you know, what are your feelings? Should MotoGP move away from Texas, or, you know, perhaps could it squeeze in another date?
I mean, first of all, I interviewed Jerry Burgess in, 2009 or 2010 about Laguna Seca, and he'd refer to it as a shitty little track then. Because the bikes they barely got out of fifth gear. It's always been a very small track. Turn one at Laguna is still one of my very favorite corners, sort of anywhere, just because of the way it is. The you know, over the crest, blind before that hard hairpin at turn two. But it's not really safe. It's not really suited to, I think it'd be like, I'd love to see Moto2 at Laguna. I think Moto2 at Laguna would be fantastic. I don't think MotoGP would. I think MotoGP is too big, too fast, too much aero. Even with the new rules, it'll still be too fast, too much aero for Laguna Seca. I think we're more likely to see World Superbikes at Laguna Seca. I think Flat Rock looks very interesting. It's in a bit of a sort of a strange place, sort of caught between two sort of large cities, but at least an hour and a half away from both of them. So I don't know how much accommodation or whatever is going to be around it. It risks becoming a little bit of an Aragon in that respect. But it does look being like being a proper full-scale Grand Prix worthy facility. And it's in the heart of US motorsports territory, not motorcycle racing territory, but motorsports territory, because it's sort of in the heart of NASCAR and the other sort of like motor racing stuff. So yeah, I think it's an interesting thing, and I don't think it will replace Texas, because I think it's much more likely that we'll see two tracks. The only problem is it's still quite a long way from Austin, but it's closer to Austin than, say, Indianapolis or Laguna might be. Although I am now going to have to go onto Google Maps and actually find out whether I'm talking absolute nonsense or not. I mean, I know I have a rough sense of US geography, but I'm likely to be proven wrong.
Neil, are you a fan of COTA? Do you think the MotoGP should really sort of make its home there for the long term?
I'm a fan of so many things about COTA, maybe just not the track layout itself. I think we've talked about it a few times in this pod in the past. It's not like we've had a ton of great racing to go off there. There have been notable good races, but they've kind of been the exception rather than the rule. It's a series of heavy braking zones and low gear corners, hairpins don't really lend themselves to good close racing. I really hope to be proved wrong this year. But the setting is cool. The city of Austin is fantastic. It's pretty expensive, but then I guess where in the US is not that way at the moment. I think it's a pretty iconic venue for sure. But yeah, I just wish that the circuit, they could chop a few little bits off it, because I think it's close to being a fantastic track. The first two sectors are fantastic, but it gets a bit Mickey Mouse, I think, in the middle part after the back straight. And that really, I think, has a negative impact on the racing.
American listeners or Moto America fans, send us some suggestions. Where would you like to see MotoGP racing in the US? Should it be Laguna Seca, somewhere like Miller, Barber? Let us know your thoughts. 2024 means 25 years of fly racing. You might be wondering what fly racing actually consists of. Well, they are one of the biggest gear names in off-road riding and competition, but they also have a vast spread of products for all two-wheeled activities. When you want a new jacket or gloves or protection, you tend to think of, say, Alpine Stars, Dainese, Revit, or more, but fly racing is also a name that should be on your radar for quality products. Have a browse at flyracing.com. We were speaking about COTA, and let's go a bit more into that subject. Guys, question number five for you. Who could potentially clean up this weekend, Alex Rins or Marc Marquez? Because we've only had three riders to win in the MotoGP class since 2013, three different brands, in fact, and this is going to be the 11th Grand Prix at the venue. Dave, your vote first.
Well, I mean, like Pekka Badiai looked like he was going to clean up last year until he decided to crash at turn two because he wasn't really paying attention.
Because the bike was too good, Div. The bike was too good.
Because the bike was too stable, good, which is the best excuse for crashing ever. Yeah, that's right. I mean, turn two has also been resurfaced. So the bumps, because there were some horrible bumps there, used to be quite interesting sitting. You go up over the hill, and then you can sort of sit on the inside of the track, looking across at it, and you would see the as riders pitched into it, that there was a big bump right on the inside where they were turning in, which they would try and avoid. But if you didn't, you could see the suspension bottoming. So I think the track is going to be an awful lot faster because of that, and because they've repaved the stadium section there as well. That is going to help the Ducatis, I think, also. I think Pekka Bagnaia has something to prove. I think Jorge Martin really has something to prove. But if there's going to be a track where Marc Marquez is going to come into his own, it's going to be here. The Yamaha does okay around COTA, so yes, there's a good chance that Alex Rins will be close to the podium, but I don't think he's going to clean up. If we're going to go with who's going to clean up, the obvious choice would be Marc Marquez, but I would keep an eye on Bagnaia versus Martin, because that is shaping up to be properly tasty.
Neil, Jack Miller and Jorge Martin won COTA in Moto3. You also have Maverick Viñales, Pecco Bagnaia and Raul Fernandez who won in Moto2. So there's quite a few riders on the grid who have previous victorious form at the venue. As Dave mentioned as well, I mean, Alex Rins, Honda's only win last year. He's still not fully fit. I mean, when you see him limping around the paddock, and of course he's trying to get used to the Yamaha, Dave pointed out that extra bit of top speed might help on that along that vast straight that they have. But I mean, it's this could be an hour of reckoning for Marc Marquez, right? I mean, this is the first, I don't want to say, what's the equivalent of like a match point or something? I don't know, first favorable hunting ground for him in terms of his reference with the Ducati this year.
The first free kick?
Direct free kick, perhaps. Yeah. Penalty. Ooh. God, David Emmett come out of the football metaphors. I'm going to retire.
I think you need to rewrite this section, Ed, to be honest. This analogy is all wrong. But yeah, I think it's definitely going to be the first weekend this year that people expect Marquez to win. No one did that, I think, in Qatar, nor did they do that in Portugal. Whereas this is going to be different. Obviously, Mark didn't attend last year's race because he was still recovering from that thumb injury that he suffered in Portugal. But the previous year, he wasn't successful, but he had that wonderful fight back from the dodgy start where I think something happened on the line. Basically, one of his mechanics hit one of his sensors, I think, which caused him to get a really terrible getaway when they were moving the tire warmer on the grid. And then obviously his record before that speaks for itself. So yeah, you would think that Mark is going to be up there. I mean, he's been pretty competitive in the races we've had so far. I think with a better qualifying, he could have been fighting for the podium on Sunday in Portugal. He is still making these little mistakes, though, when he's really in critical moments and pushing for fast lap times. He's still kind of reverting back to how he used to do things on the Honda. And I think that is something that could hold him back a little bit this weekend, because we know how long and how complicated this track is. It's the longest, I think, on the calendar. It's got the most turns on the calendar. There's a lot to kind of get your head around and to learn. But certainly what Mark was able to do in the Honda through the first sector, I mean, no one could ever really live with that whenever he was sort of in his pomp at this track. So yeah, I think he goes in probably as the favorite. One name that you didn't mention that I would also, in fact, two that I would like to point out. First, Maverick Viñales always was really quick at this circuit.
I'm sorry. I thought you said Maverick Viñales.
I did, yes. And I don't know if you were paying attention, Dave, but he was actually quite good in Portugal. It was like one of the first times that I've been able to say that for a while. And the second is Andrea Bastianini, who won the race here in 2022 and won it brilliantly, in fact. And we saw Bastianini in Portugal, pole position and on the podium in the race on Sunday. Yeah, I think, you know, we're starting to see the kind of the best of the beast again. So, yeah, two names that I would kind of have roughly on the kind of provisional roster of challengers.
Maverick came close to being the first rider to win with three different brands. I mean, the sprint.
He did win with three. No. He won with three different brands.
So we're counting the sprint.
This whole separate. Yeah, oh, of course we are. Of course we are. It's an incredibly stupid difference to make. It's a, you know, look, it's not a full length Grand Prix, but if you're going to count a six race sprint would be after a red flag as a race result, as a victory, then you have to count
a sprint race. It was a feature race on a Sunday.
Oh, right. Well, let's scrap all of those races that Rossi won in Assen from his record then, because that wasn't on a Sunday either. That was a Saturday race. So it's nonsense. Maverick Viñales became the first rider to win on three different brands in the GP era, I think, in the MotoGP era. So no, full marks for that. But that means that he's going to finish 15th in COTA.
No, but I think
that's just the way
I'm
it works.
I'm siding with Neil here. I mean, the Aprilia gearbox couldn't go the full distance in Portugal. So, you know, technically that's not really a Grand Prix win.
It's nonsense. It is absolute nonsense. There is no point. The sooner we get rid of this, I mean, the other thing is there aren't even decent statistics on, or you can't find decent statistics on sprint wins and sprint podiums on the Dorna website. They really need to fix that. One of these days, I'm going to build my own database and sort that out, just so that I can actually look all these things up. But no, I mean, I don't care what people say. That was a Grand Prix victory, and it was, I mean, hats off, it was a really superb race, and that is Maverick Viñales' problem in a nutshell. on his day, he's just outstanding. It's just that, you know, his day isn't every Sunday like it is for Marc Márquez, for Pekka Bagnaia, for Fabio Quartararo, for Brad Binder, for all of these other riders.
Well, you could argue if his RSGP wasn't flicking out of fifth and sixth gear on Sunday, then he would have had that Grand Prix as well, or that race, you know?
Yeah, no,
well,
definitely.
Why not?
I mean, definitely.
Well, he was about a second behind Jorge Martin with one lap to go.
Yeah, with a dodgy gearbox. Yeah, I mean, all right, what ifs, ifs and buts, you know, I know. But I think, you know, it was an incredibly competitive weekend for him. And yeah, why can't he do it again? Let's wait and see. Listen, guys, on our last point on this podcast, because we are coming up, of course, to the only Grand Prix, well, the American Grand Prix on the slate, on the calendar. So I'm going to ask you for your favorite American Grand Prix memory. Over to you first, Neil. Is there anything that stand out from the many visits? Was 88 Laguna Seca the first American Grand Prix? I think it was the...
No, I don't think it was the first American Grand Prix. I think it was the first Grand Prix at Laguna Seca for sure. I think there might have been one prior to that. Oh, God, I really should have done this research before.
Well, I put you on the spot with a question, but I mean, it was it was a couple of years, I want to say to 90, perhaps. Was there 3 years at Laguna?
No, there was more. I think it stopped in 94 was the last one.
Okay.
Then it came back in 2005. So yeah, there's a couple. I mean, there's a few obvious ones, which I will leave to you gentlemen, but I enjoyed very much. There was a great Rennie Schwantz battle at Laguna Seca in 1990, before Schwantz high-sided out the final turn and broke his wrist. But that was a really interesting fight between those two. At home, on kind of Rainey's home territory. I think his house almost looks out over part of the track still. So it really was very much his territory. And Schwantz was riding with the camo helmet scheme at that point as well, I seem to remember. And then I would also say my first race that I did in America was in 2015 at Indianapolis. And there was a great battle that day between Mark and Jorge Lorenzo. And this was peak Lorenzo, probably in the best form of his life. And he was sort of doing that hunting Mark down. I know, in fact, he was leading most of the race and then Mark mugged him right at the end. But it was a great kind of head-to-head between the two, well, two of the top three guys in the championship that year. So, yeah, that was pretty special.
Speaking of Indianapolis, I think 2012, Casey Stoner's high side. I mean, if you look at the footage of the accident, I mean, it is brutal. I mean, the bike is absolutely trashed. And I think he might have even broken his leg in that accident. I can't...
He did. He suffered very severe injuries in his foot. It kept him out for a very, very long time. Actually put Jonathan Ray on the Honda for a little while. And I think that was one of the sort of like one of the events that just sort of reinforced his conviction that it was time for him to retire.
One of my favorite memories, Dave, Nicky Hayden's 2006 win at Laguna Seca. I'm not sure if it was in 05 or 06 where he did the jig on the podium, but, you know, I'm going to pick 06 because, you know, that was his championship year as well. It felt like a real sort of zenith in the modern era of MotoGP for the US. It hasn't really come around since. You could say one day in Assen for Ben Spies kind of put it back up there again, and Colin Edwards had some flashes, but I can't believe it's sort of 7 years since Nicky Hayden's been gone now. So, you know, yeah, I hope we'll sort of think of him and remember him when we go back to COTA this weekend. And of course, there's the Rossi Stoner battle in 2008. So what's your nomination?
There's a few things. First of all, I think we have to go for best livery, which is obviously the 2005 Yamaha, the yellow and black livery for Colin Edwards and Valentino Rossi, which is just the best looking MotoGP bike. It's the second best looking Grand Prix bike ever after the Kajiva, and it's the best looking sort of special livery. It just looked absolutely fantastic. Obviously, like 2008 was thrilling, generally because it was such a visceral race. You could feel the those two really hated each other by that point. And Rossi had to win. He knew he had to win. And he did everything he could to keep Rossi, to keep Stoner behind him. Again, during the same interview that I did with Jerry Burgess about it, he sort of like said, like, they only had one objective in that race, and that was to get ahead of Stoner, because if Stoner got ahead, they knew that they'd lost the race. So it was just like, get ahead of him, get in his way, stop him from getting past, whatever happens, and then do what you can and then see what happens at the end. That was great. But my favorite personal memory is Indianapolis. Was it 10 or 11? Kenny Roberts riding the Yamaha 750 around the Indianapolis fairground, riding the mile. I got to stand trackside. That was just visceral. I cannot explain how amazing that was and how fast he was going. I mean, he was properly pushing that thing. That wasn't a demonstration lap. He was demonstrating how fast that bike was, not sort of, you know, isn't it a pretty motorcycle? But I think in terms of GP, it has to be Marc Márquez sprinting down pit lane, you know, parking his bike up against the pit lane wall after it broke down, jumping over the pit lane, sprinting down to get on his bike number two, and then going out and setting a pole lap. That to me was just exceptional.
Yeah, 2015, I think probably one of the best pole laps that any of us have seen. And it was so rough and so wild, but he still managed to do it despite having got his heart rate up to, I'm sure, around, I don't know, 150, 160 for that sprint down pit lane. So, yeah, that was, I think, one of Mark's best moments.
I think you're talking about your own running heart rate there, Neil. I think Marc Márquez's level might be slightly lower.
Oh, mine's much higher than that, I can assure you.
I mean, Rossi Stoner in 2008 was pretty cool to see. I mean, when you watched it live and you saw the post-race reaction, you thought, well, you know, this is a proper spat. But it was kind of confusing as well, because I remember thinking, Rossi, you're a cheeky bastard. But then you kind of thought Casey's reaction to it was a little bit, I don't know, it was overly serious, I don't know.
That was the point. No, that was the point. That was exactly the point. The only way they were going to beat Casey Stoner that year was by making Casey Stoner beat Casey Stoner. And Rossi really got under his skin in part because, I mean, like, it was just this. I mean, it would be really interesting if that happened this year to see how Race Direction would handle it. Because there was a couple of times where you thought, you know, somebody deserves a long lap penalty, and I'm not quite sure who. Rossi was clearly trying to rough him up in a legal way, and stop him, but and he knew that he didn't have the bike to take the fight to Stoner, so he had to find a different way. He was doing all sorts of things. I think the run across the dirt is irrelevant, really. I mean, it's fun. It's entertaining. And I think our friend, the late Andrew Wheeler, made quite a lot of money off of that off of the photograph sequence that he made of that. But like some of the other passes he was making around there were just really, really good. I also have to say, to go back to turn one at Laguna, Casey Stoner through to, I think Casey Stoner passed someone, and I can't remember who.
Lorenzo.
Through to, sorry?
Jorge Lorenzo.
Yeah, at turn one.
Yes.
Honestly, passing someone at turn one at Laguna Seca is probably the bravest move you can make anywhere ever. And that was really special.
Guys, just before we wrap things up here on the Paddock Podcast, the Paddock Pass Podcast, let's hear your predictions for victory this weekend. Put the money on the table. Neil, you first.
I'm going to have to say Mark.
Bold choice. Dave?
Not really.
I would like to go for Mark, but I think I am going to go for, it's going to be a comeback. It's going to be Pecco's comeback this week. And I think Pecco's going to do the double. I mean, I don't think so. I think Mark is going to win, but I'm sort of like thinking, I think it'd be much more interesting if Pecco did that.
That's
double.
My tip as well, actually. I've got Bang Nia down for the win. He was looking like he was going to do it last year. And now, like you say, he's going to sort of right the wrong, so to speak.
They've resurfaced turn two, so there's no reason for it to fall off.
Well, that's it. Thanks for listening to Dave, Neil and I drone on for yet another week. Podcast 400 is coming up. Anybody you'd like to hear from on the Paddock Pass podcast, then let us know through X SoundCloud comments or YouTube comments. We'll also listen to any questions or bench rating topics you might have through the same channels. Don't forget to save your MotoGP fantasy team changes this week and join the Alpine Stars Paddock Pass podcast league, which you can find with a simple search on MotoGP.com and in the Game Hub section. We'll be back with the first of our daily Paddock Note shows from Thursday at the Circuit of the Americas. That one will be free for everybody to listen to on Patreon, but then we'll have interviews and more reactions on Friday and Saturday for our Paddock Insiders. Join up for just $10 a month or try a free 7-day trial and find out what you're missing. Other than that, we'll have our post-race show posted as soon as we can on Sunday evening.